Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what President Obama must do to reverse the momentum in the presidential campaign, which the media claims is shifting to Romney's favor. Adam Green, the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, joins us to discuss how Obama can refute a blizzard of lies coming from Romney while putting forth his vision for the future. Then we'll look into the Norwegian Nobel Committee, who have just awarded the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize to the European Union, which has some people scratching their heads. A Norwegian peace activist, Fredrik Heffermel, who has criticized the committee for not complying with Alfred Nobel's will, joins us. He is the author of The Nobel Peace Prize, What Nobel Really Wanted. Then finally, we will discuss the fate and future of Social Security, about which in the first debate, President Obama inexplicably said that he and Romney shared the same plans and policies. Nothing could be further from the truth, and we will discuss the Republican war on Social Security with Eric Kingston, who served as a policy advisor on two presidential commissions on the future of Social Security. We will discuss Pete Peterson's successful billion-dollar campaign to propagandize and demonize and invent a Social Security crisis. And joining me now is Adam Green. He's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which is a 1 million member grassroots organization dedicated to helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win. He formerly serves as director of strategic campaigns and civic communications director for MoveOn.org. What's your sense of what President Obama can do on Tuesday night? Clearly, Vice President Biden has teed it up for him in the debate that he had with Paul Ryan. But Obama really has to knock it out of the ballpark because, according to the mainstream media, the momentum is shifting towards Romney, who is ahead in all of even in the national polls. So, what would your advice be?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of specifics that we could talk about, but the big thematic thing that pulls it all together is President Obama needs to show some fight. You know, the famous circus guy, Phineas Taylor Barnum, used to say, if you want to attract a crowd, pick a fight. And one thing that we saw in the first debate was President Obama seemed almost intentionally to not want to actually fight with Mitt Romney. And that gets directly to a point that I guess he'll be talking about later on the show, which is his inexplicable comment that he and Romney agree on Social Security, which is definitely, you know, not true. And Mitt Romney actively picked a guy who wrote the plan to privatize Social Security as his VP nominee. So I think at the end of the day, the reviews will be very good if President Obama goes into this debate willing to actually draw contrast and pick some fights with Mitt Romney. That's what people want to see in a strong leader.
So it seems to me, though, that what happened here was, in this first debate, was that Romney was very tactically shrewd, and he took the gamble that the American people essentially hadn't been paying attention to this long campaign about, you know, which is both of them have spent billions on, and Obama has successfully framed Romney as this Wall Street predator, and you know, his 47% remark had helped him. Even Romney's big money donors on the Republican side were abandoning him. They figured he was a loser. But he figured that I will come out at the time when, and in fact, 70 million people were watching, so he clearly made the right choice here. People will be watching for the first time, and I'll be this different guy, this likable guy that has nothing to do with my previous positions. And then Obama's going to look like a liar, and everything he said before is going to look like a lie. And that seems to have worked. The American people, perhaps they're shallow and capricious, but they seem to have bought it.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, you or I would be embarrassed to go on a stage and say things that directly disputed things that we have said, you know, just weeks or months ago. But I guess Mitt Romney has a certain gift for just being able to ignore that type of self-shame. And it did play to his benefit. But again, I think it comes back to you know, the idea of is President Obama willing to fight? You know, President Obama controls his own destiny in terms of whether people believe Mitt Romney's lies. If those lies go undisputed, right, if Mitt Romney is allowed to lie and President Obama won't pick a fight, well, then why shouldn't voters who are watching believe Mitt Romney? If it was wrong, then President Obama would dispute it. I think we actually saw Joe Biden really kind of rise to that test and, you know, knock things out of the ballpark during his debate when Paul Ryan falsely said that the stimulus was a waste of money, that it didn't create jobs. And not only did Joe Biden say that wasn't true, but he said, there are two letters that you, Paul Ryan, wrote to me, Joe Biden, which asked for stimulus money to create jobs in your district. And anybody watching at home has to just think, oh, Joe Biden is clearly right, and what Paul Ryan said was clearly wrong. So again, I think if we have that same level of kind of fact-checking on stage and correcting the record on stage, making a proactive case on stage, and drawing key contrasts on stage from President Obama, then he'll recover some of the momentum that he lost.
Again, I'm speaking with Adam Green, who's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which is a 1-million-member grassroots organization dedicated to helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win. He formerly served as Director of Strategic Campaigns and Civic Communications Director for MoveOn.org. So how do you do both of those things at the same time? In other words, shoot down the blizzard of lies that will come from Romney and at the same time put forth your vision.
Well, you know, I would say that even if Mitt Romney wasn't lying, it still would fall on President Obama to essentially explain two positions, right? Elections are about contrasts. Elections are about choices. And it's really incumbent on anybody who's making their case to the people to say, here's what I believe, and here's what my opponent believes. Now, if the opponent just happened to lie about their position, you know, there's a little bit of nuance that you put in there about, you know, here's what he said about what he believes. But no matter what, you have to make the case about what Mitt Romney believes. So I actually don't think it's that tough, a needle to thread for President Obama to say, look, Mitt, you know, you just said that you're going to, you know, that you care about Social Security, but, you know, you're the guy who appointed Paul Ryan, who wrote the plan to privatize Social Security and Medicare, for that matter. You know, I'm the one who did X, Y, and Z. And, you know, through that contrast, voters will get a sense of where these candidates stand. You know, I would say that you mentioned, you know, some of our mission at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, boldprogressives.org, and one candidate that we're working with a lot this cycle is Elizabeth Warren. And she really did knock things out of the ballpark this past week in a big Massachusetts Senate debate against Republican Senator Scott Brown, where she, you know, said, I will not cut Social Security and Medicare benefits, my opponent will. You know, on women's issues, here's what I believe, and here's what my opponent actually voted. And I think that if President Obama takes a couple pages from that playbook, he'll be very well served this week.
So, Adam Green, it seems to me that from day one, the Romney campaign has been so brazen, it's breathtaking. The first ad that they ever made was back in Iowa when he was running in the primaries, where he put John McCain's words in President Obama's mouth. And if you go through the entire campaign, there's just endless examples. And now, and the latest one was in the vice presidential campaign, where they kept repeating, where Paul Ryan kept repeating this lie that the Obama administration had referred to the Assad murderers in Syria as reformers. And even on Fox News, one of the Fox personalities, I guess they're called, he was challenged, a representative of the Romney campaign, by saying, look, we've checked with the facts checkers that there's absolutely no evidence that anybody in the Obama administration has ever referred to Assad as a reformer. And the spokesperson for Romney just lied again. I mean, it turns out that the only reference was Hillary Clinton saying that it was being critical of some U.S. senators who had referred to Assad as a reformer. Again, they were putting somebody else's words in Hillary's mouth. So it's just, I find it extraordinary. Is it that it's just gone on too long that people have got used to it, or just do we live in a culture where the truth doesn't matter anymore?
Yeah, I think when the history books are written about this election cycle, a major, major chapter, if not the whole book, will be about how the idea of truth is being called into question. objective truth. And, you know, it's definitely a challenge. You know, I think it's a challenge for candidates, and it's a challenge for the media. And I think the easier part to address is, you know, the media. You know, there's a real conundrum that reporters have to face, where what do you do if one candidate lies once or says something that's not true once, and the other candidate says something that's not true 20 times? Do you write a story that's essentially 50-50, that says this person says something not true and this person says something not true, and ignore the other 19 instances on one candidate's part? Or do you actually write a story about one candidate having a consistent record of saying things that are not true? If you do that, you know, the stigma that a reporter might be afraid of is being called biased. But really, it's biased if you don't cover the truth, right? And I think when we look at the media culture that we have right now, this idea of false equivalency, the idea of saying everybody is equally responsible, the idea, you know, similarly, that we have gridlock in Washington because everybody fights, as opposed to, no, Republicans are intentionally obstructing the government from doing anything. Like, not reporting this accurately really distorts our entire democratic dialogue. So the media, I think the media, if they were doing their job, actually can do can find a solution pretty quickly, which is just call a spade, debunk the lies, and if someone's a real liar, you have to say that. For a politician, I think it's a little bit more of a challenge. You know, what do you do when your opponent in a debate is saying 20 things that are not true? How do you actually correct every single one? My guess, honestly, is that on some foreign policy issues, you know, Assad, you know, most voters, particularly swing voters, are not going to be casting their vote off of that. So if a politician decided not to check some things like that, I would understand. But for the things that voters are really paying attention to, are the Social Security plans really the same or not? Did the stimulus create jobs or drive up our deficit and not create any jobs? These are key, key parts of the Obama legacy. You know, is Obamacare a big waste of money, or is it going to help millions of lives? It seems like just due diligence in the course of preparing for a debate would say, let's identify the lies that are actually impactful lies our opponents have already said. Let's get the most damning rebuttals possible, like Joe Biden having Paul Ryan's letters right there, and let's be prepared to cite those in the debates. And again, I think if President Obama does that, he'll be pretty well served. I guess the curveball would be if Mitt Romney decides to just create completely new lies out of thin air. You know, the airtight rebuttal might not be there, but I think, you know, in the lion's share of the cases, there's a degree of preparation that Joe Biden apparently did that would really serve President Obama well, too.
So Adam Green, again, co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, a 1 million-member grassroots organization dedicated to helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win, and formerly served as director of strategic campaigns and civic communications for MoveOn.org. What happened in that first debate? I mean, obviously, a lot of people have been trying to analyze the apparent clear lackluster performance on the part of the president, and the sort of hyped up aggressive salesmanship, if you will, of Mitt Romney. Was it that the president's sort of just has disdain for this obvious salesman who'll say anything to close the deal? I mean, I don't explain, because obviously the contrast is pretty profound with Vice President Biden reacting to the absurdities that Ryan was putting out, which were identical to the absurdities that Romney's been putting out, particularly this constant refrain about Medicare Advantage. And everybody knows, that looked into it, that it was a huge Republican boondoggle, a gift to the insurance companies, that was a massive waste of money. It's easy to refute these things. So I just, in terms of, you know, now we have the split screen, which seems to be reasonable that the other person can react. The only reaction that we got from Obama in that first campaign was him sort of looking down at his notes. You know, he barely made eye contact. And I wonder whether it'll be different this time, whether you will see the president listening to this fatuous blather coming from this salesman.
Yeah, well, you know, I would guess that on, you know, that question, we will. It's hard to imagine the president watching the video of his own debate and not knowing to look up in the future. You know, on the broader question of, you know, what went on in that debate, I don't know if it was a strategic decision or not to essentially go in there and not put up a fight. But, you know, if it was, then the theory might have been coming out of this debate, no news is good news, I'm already leading, so let's just try to make this as non-confrontational as, and kind of as non-story a debate as possible. But again, when you do that, you cede the debate to the guy who's willing to fight. So I think that, again, at the end of the day, he needs to be willing to get in, up in there. And if he does have disdain for Mitt Romney, and particularly Mitt Romney's ideas, he needs to show it, and he needs to draw contrasts. He doesn't have to be mean and nasty, but he needs to say, Mitt, this is where you stand, and this is why I disagree, and here's why I've done, and here's what I'll do. If he does that, you know, it sounds so obvious. It's not what he did in the first debate. He just did not draw that contrast. So we're bold progressives. We want a little bit of boldness from this president, and I think, you know, the lion's share of voters, you know, want their president to be strong as well. And if he sits back and lets Mitt Romney lie, there's no reason for voters of their own volition to think it's a lie. The president needs to, debunk those lies.
Well, Adam Green, you've had run-ins with this White House before. I think Rahm Emanuel used the F word in telling you to get the hell out of there. Or I think he said effing retard or something, because you were arguing even back then that they should get bolder and more progressive. And it seems to be there's a kind of, a sort of smug centrism there at the White House that is blind to the needs of their own constituencies. I mean, yeah. We want a winner. We don't want wimps. We've had enough wimps on the Democratic side. We've had the Mondales and the Dukakises and the Kerrys, and it's just a history of these guys wimping out and wimping out in the face of the equally fatuous candidates like Gore allowed George W. Bush to win 3 debates, for God's sake. So what's going on in that White House? This kind of advice that Obama must have gotten from these people smacks to me of that sort of smug centrism that gets you nowhere.
Yeah, well, if you ever want to have a complete hour-long discussion on this, I'm happy to. This really gets kind of the core philosophy of our organization at boldprogressives.org. But just to quickly, make sure your listeners know, the comment, the Rahm Emanuel comment that you mentioned came during the healthcare fight when our organization was pushing all Democrats to have a backbone and stand up for the most popular thing in the healthcare proposal, which was a public option, a public health insurance option run by the government that competes head-to-head with private insurance, but that doesn't have a profit motive to deny people care. And we would do polling in state after state, even supposedly red states, and people wanted this public option. So we ran television ads pressuring Senator Ben Nelson in Nebraska, who is rightly unpopular and therefore retiring, because he was not supportive of the public option. And Rahm Emanuel, in some meeting, referenced these ads that we were doing against this Democratic senator, pressuring him, and called them effing retarded, which really is reflective of a broader mentality of not pressuring politicians to do what their constituents want. I mean, I really hope that at some point in my lifetime, I live in a world where there are two parties that actually represent 50% of the people each, and where, therefore, compromise is a necessity in order to bring the country forward. But we're living in a world right now where, frankly, on almost every economic issue of the day, whether it's should we cut Social Security benefits, should we cut Medicare benefits, should we raise taxes on the rich, should we ask Wall Street to pay their fair share and be reformed, should we hold Wall Street bankers accountable, these are 80-20 issues. And, what do you do if you're the Democratic Party? And 80% of the people, including many Republican voters, are on your side on these key issues of the day. And Republicans in Washington draw a line in the sand and give you 0 votes. Do you throw your hands up in the air and say, well, I guess we don't have the votes. Better compromise and take the 20% position, a position that gives away the farm to the insurance companies and the big drug companies? Or do you actually pressure politicians to be in touch with their constituents? Do you go outside of D.C. like we did in this TV ad and like Obama for America could do with their huge grassroots army and pressure people in their home states? And if you do, my guess is that they'll crack after a while, because the only thing that allows them to draw these absurd lines in the sand that are out of touch with their own constituents is that nobody ever talks about it. There's no reason for the media to cover it if there's no clash, if the Democrats are not even attacking them for it. So, generally speaking, you know, we think that good policy and good politics go hand in hand in this current era. And the idea of kind of cutting back room deals with big insurance companies and stuff like that is, you know, just lines you up for defeat and results in things like, unfortunately, the mandate that we got as opposed to, you know, Medicare for All or a public option, which would have been a way more popular version of Obamacare. So, you know, I agree with your top line point, which is, you know, we need people who are not wimps. But I want to make clear to your listeners that there's a real philosophy around this, one that does not pit the base against things that are politically smart, but that actually tries to move the Democratic Party in a position where they're willing to buck these corporate interests and adopt these 80% sides of these 80-20 issues.
Well, Adam Green, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Adam Green, who's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which is a 1 million-member grassroots organization dedicated to helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win. He formerly served as Director of Strategic Campaigns and Civic Communications Director for MoveOn.org. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how awarding the European Union the Nobel Prize for Peace goes against the will of Alfred Nobel.
Children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds we're reaching out for peace. In our hearts we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts a sense of master feed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Fredrik Heffermøll, a Norwegian jurist, writer, and translator. He formerly worked as a lawyer and civil servant from 1965 to 1982 and was the first Secretary General of the Norwegian Humanist Association from 1980 to 1982. He made his mark as an independent writer and activist for peace and against nuclear arms. And since August 2007, he has been a staunch critic of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, which, according to Heffermøll, has failed to comply with the will of Alfred Nobel. He is the author of The Nobel Peace Prize, What Nobel Really Wanted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fredrik Heffermøll.
Thanks a lot.
And clearly, giving the Nobel Peace Prize to the European Union has raised some eyebrows and caused a certain amount of puzzlement. Let's begin with, and I know your position is that, and we'll get into this, this goes against Alfred Nobel's will in the sense that the European Union has been engaged in wars rather than stopping wars, and there are various countries included in the Union that have very, very big arms industries and export arms and depend upon the export of arms. But let's just go to the recent record of Europe as a peacemaker. Going back to Bosnia and the Balkans, wasn't exactly a sterling example, particularly Srebrenica, where the Dutch soldiers essentially allowed the Serbian killers to massacre about 8,000 people in the worst atrocity since the Nazis.
Yes, that's right. And it was particularly bad because it destroyed the reputation very much of the United Nations as a peacekeeper, because it was UN forces supplied by Holland who were stood back and did nothing to protect the secure city which Srebrenica was supposed to be. And you are making a very good review of the profile of the European Union since the idea of the whole idea of Nobel's will was to establish a prize for demilitarization of international affairs. This is particularly, it's not at all the case with the European Union. First of all, it's a local, regional arrangement between nations, which has no ambition in the direction of demilitarization. Then, as you said, it also has a very high, it plans to develop a European army and a rapid deployment force. And there is one technical aspect of the, this is about economy, which in between the nations of the European Union, it is completely forbidden for nations to intervene, strengthen the economy or stimulate the economy by state subsidies. It cannot be done in any way. But if they want to do this, they have one option, which is to produce weapons, because matters of military and security affairs are exempted from the European Union treaties. So actually, they are a dry, this technical aspect, which very few are aware of the European Union, makes it a kind of driver in a driving force in arms races. So, and it has some three of the biggest arms exporters in the world as members: the Britain and France and Germany.
Well, it seems to me, Frederick Heffermel, that the motive that at least has been expressed about why the Nobel Committee awarded the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize to the European Union was, and they stated this, that the European Union has brought together countries that have responsible for the last two world wars, and it seems to me that that's not a particularly profound reading of history. I think the truth of the matter is that the combatants in World War II had just exhausted the French, the British, and the Germans, and the Russians, and that the real emerging post-war powers were the Soviet Union and the United States, and that in effect, by forming a union, they became at least a player on the world stage. But I think history is the reason why they are no longer at war with each other. They simply were exhausted. And many analysts argue that because of the folly of George W. Bush in this country, sending Americans off to losing wars in the Middle East, that the United States isn't to some extent becoming a spent force as well, at least in the Middle East. So what do you think of my analysis of what the real underlying facts are about why the Europeans are not at war and have formed a union?
They are also members of the United Nations, which is a global security system, which has as its main purpose to end all use of military force. So alone by obedience to their fundamental obligations as a member of the United Nations, they should not go to war against each other. And unfortunately, the shock on a horror of war has faded a little after the Second World War, and now we are back in a situation where the UN obligations are not taken seriously any longer, and where, for instance, Obama, he delivered, as I have very profoundly explained in my book, I think I used 16 pages on the Obama acceptance speech of for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. And he defended the right of the United States to more or less go to war whenever it served American interests and needs. So this speech, he didn't mention the UN and UN obligations at all. So this speech, I think, was the worst affront to the idea of Alfred Nobel on the demilitarization of international politics that has ever been heard.
A lot of people weren't too happy about Henry Kissinger getting the Nobel Peace Prize back during the Vietnam War.
No, absolutely.
So let's talk. Let's talk then, Frederick Havamal, again, the author of the Nobel Peace Prize. What Nobel really wanted, just in terms of your objections to the awarding the European Union the 2012 Nobel Prize for Peace. Your main point here is that the European Union is a military force. It wants to be a regional power. It has created a rapid deployment force. It has three countries involved, some of the biggest arms exporters in the world. Two of the countries involved are nuclear powers. In general, you just feel that this is an affront to the very idea of the Nobel Prize. Who would you have awarded it to? Is there an example out there of a country or a group of countries that are really in the spirit of Nobel?
No, well, countries aren't eligible for this prize. It's not meant to go to countries or unions or countries. It's meant to go to the grassroots peace movement, which is opposing power and power games and insisting on the demilitarization of international affairs and building an international system which can be a robust peace. So actually, as I describe in my book, there is around all the UN conferences on various issues, not least in arms and nuclear weapons issues, etc., there is a whole lot of civil society organizations. And they are advising the diplomats, and they are providing them with information and arguing and making proposals. They play a very important role and they are not loyal to religious or national divisions between them. They are cooperating as a whole with the same idea as Nobel had of a global cooperation.
Well, just in closing then, is there an example to your mind of that kind of person that is fighting for peace at the grassroots level that would be worthy of this award instead of the European Union?
Yeah, well, I have indicated around 300 persons. Organizations involved in this work in the book. Mm-hmm. And there are, of course, the Americans are the group who has received absolutely the largest amount of prizes of any nation. I think it's around 40. Or it's actually one-third of the prizes have gone to Americans. So it's hard to take another American, but there are two Americans. It's Gene Sharp, the world's preeminent expert on nonviolence, and then it's Richard Falk, the professor in Princeton, who is an expert in international law and international organization. Great expert on disarmament issues and how to organize a better world.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Frederick Havamal.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Fredrik Heffermehl, who's a Norwegian jurist, writer, and translator. He formerly worked as a lawyer and civil servant from 1965 to 1982 and was the first Secretary General of the Norwegian Humanist Association. He later made his mark as an independent writer and activist for peace and against nuclear weapons. And since August of 2007, he has been a staunch critic of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, which, according to Heffermehl, has failed to comply with the will of Alfred Nobel. He is the author of The Nobel Peace Prize, What Nobel Really Wanted. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the vice presidential debate and how Social Security was poorly framed and badly argued.
Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go to warm Haiti? Why can't we live in bliss? Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a beast train. Oh, beast train, take this country, come take me home again. Oh, beast train, sounding louder.
Send me a postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Indicate precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer. Still need me, will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Welcome back, I'm Ian Masters, this is Background Briefing, and joining us now is Erik Kingsen, who is Professor of Social Work at Syracuse University, a Senior Research Associate in the Maxwell School Center for Public Policy, and a Distinguished Fellow in Syracuse University Institute for Veterans and Military Families. Kingsen is also founding co-director of the Social Security Works, an organization which launched and staffs the Strengthened Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. He served as a policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982-83 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reforms. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erik Kingsen.
Thank you for having me.
And this idea that Social Security is broke was the opening question that Martha Raddatz of ABC, the moderator in the vice presidential debate, posed. And she's been widely praised, although a lot of conservatives have condemned her. By and large, she got pretty good marks for moderating that debate. But that was a pretty egregious question to begin with, given that it plays into this conservative canard that Social Security is broke, when in fact it pays for itself.
You've said it exactly correctly. It was such an unfortunate framing of the issue. It plays into this narrative that somehow the Social Security program is not sustainable, is not doing its job. Patently wrong. And let me just back up a bit. Let's understand why we built Social Security. We built it to provide broad protection to the American public, generations of politicians, Republicans and Democrats, in fact, contributed to the development of the program, and every citizen who works has contributed to its ongoing maintenance. It is designed to protect against loss of income if a parent dies and leaves children, if a spouse dies, if a person reaches retirement age, or if we fall among the many people who become severely disabled before retirement age. It's not a very good job of that. When you look at this recent recession, we've seen pension plans go under. We've seen 401k plans, 401k and other retirement savings diminish. People have lost home equity. Some people have lost houses and their jobs. The one system that worked extremely well is Social Security. It's a solution to the nation's economic security concerns, not a problem. However, if you don't like this solution, which many people don't, and certainly Mr. Ryan doesn't, you campaign against it. You try to delegitimize it, and there's been a strong effort to do that. And very sadly, Martha Raddatz, unthinkingly, uncritically, simply picked up the narrative of the far right, which has now become a narrative that has moved sadly into the center of journalism and our politics.
And Eric Kingston, this is actually a form of class warfare. The Republicans do use that charge a lot, that every time anybody asks for tax fairness and points out the enormous and growing disparity of wealth in this country and the power of the 1% over the 99%, they quick to call it class warfare. But it seems that a very flagrant strategy on the part of the Republicans to engage in class warfare, pitting the old against the young, by spreading this lie amongst young Americans that they won't have Social Security. In fact, they'll be paying in to a system that won't, from which they won't get their benefits back. That's their tactic. I mean, and again, I got the feeling that they were able to get away, that Ryan was able to get away with quite a lot in that regard. Although, you know, by and large, most people think that Biden did a pretty good job.
Yes, she missed, and in missing an important opportunity to lay out this issue properly, she did a great disservice. I think, you know, generally she did a pretty decent job, we could say, but on this one, she really blew it. She could have said, look, we are facing a retirement income security crisis. There is data telling us that 2/3 of Americans do not have sufficient savings or retirement income protection to maintain their standard of living in America. What do you propose to do about this crisis, Mr. Ryan, Mr. Biden? That opens up a whole different type of discussion. In fact, when you open up that discussion, you very quickly see, or I believe you see, that the core solution to that crisis is to strengthen and build on Social Security, because it is the foundation and it provides broad protection. You know, this idea that the program's going broke again is just patently absurd, although it's part of the pablum that we've been fed, and it's repeated over and over. But look at this. We have a system that receives contributions from employees and employers on their earnings. The contributions they make don't disappear at any time in the future unless Americans aren't going to be working in the future. So we have a system that meets all of its obligations, will provide all the benefits it owes the American people through 2033. After that, it's about 25 cents short on every dollar. That is something we need to maintain, to adjust, and it can be done quite easily. You mentioned class warfare. The same folks who are saying, oh my God, we cannot afford to stop the Bush tax cuts for the top 2% for households that make $250,000 or more. We can't do that. They're the same people who are saying Social Security is in crisis. It can't survive. It has to be radically changed. We need to privatize, cut it, pull it apart brick by brick. The fact is that the Bush tax cuts to the very well-off, the ending of the Bush tax cuts would provide virtually the same amount of revenue you need to maintain Social Security for your children and your grandchildren and your grandchildren's children, basically. It's really a matter of political will, not a matter of economic possibility. And another way of looking at it is, if we asked all Americans to make the same contribution, to pay the same rate on their earnings as 94% of Americans pay those who have less than $110,000. If all Americans did that, paid on their earnings, then the system would be virtually solvent, mathematically, virtually. There's some curlicues there, but this is not a crisis. But if you want to damage it, if you want to pull it apart, you work to delegitimize it, which has been the clear strategy for many years. And you tell young people it's not going to be there. You tell people 55 and over, don't worry, we're not going to hurt you. You tell the young, we're going to fix this by turning it into a private account, which is basically what Mr. Ryan has proposed all along.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric Kingston, Professor of Social Work at Syracuse University. He's the founding co-director of Social Security Works, an organization which launches and staffs the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. And he served as policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982-83 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. So the biggest propagandist against Social Security, and somebody that also helped underwrite and finance the Simpson-Bowles Commission, is Pete Peterson, the Wall Street billionaire, who is the owner of the Blackstone private equity company, a big Wall Street private equity firm. He's worth billions of dollars. He has a singular obsession against Social Security, and it's not conspiratorial to suggest that maybe this Wall Street billionaire wants to get his hands on that kind of money. The Republicans have always floated this idea that we should borrow the system that was experimented with in Chile by a right-wing government, where instead of the retirement funds going into Social Security, they were put into the stock market. And people with the old pensions under the government system are doing fine, and people with the new pensions are absolutely, you know, in crisis and unable to make ends meet. And Biden pointed that out in the vice presidential debate. Had the money gone into private accounts, as George W. Bush tried to do in privatizing Social Security, with the crash of 2008, where would people be? So I just don't understand why the Democrats aren't more clear about the apparent motives of those who want to destroy Social Security, in particular this Wall Street billionaire who has done more than any other single individual to demonize Social Security.
There's so many things there. I definitely want to talk about Pete Peterson, but let me talk first about the confusion about what Social Security is. Social Security is an insurance plan. You pay premiums and you receive protection. It's not a savings plan. The right and conservatives have wanted to talk about it as a savings plan. And the reality is we don't save for if our house burns down. We buy insurance to protect us because we can't save enough in those terms. Social Security provides protection against disability, against those of us who've lost spouses and are raising young children. You can't save for that in the same way, and you certainly, the broad American public can't. Pete Peterson can, and very well-off people can do that. But Peterson, to go back to Pete Peterson, Peterson was Richard Nixon's Secretary of Commerce. He has been on an anti-Social Security kick since the late 70s. He has paid. He has written and had people he has written with. He has helped advance this dialogue of a cataclysmic age wave of generations being in conflict. And he will stand up there and say he wants to deal with the debt to protect future generations. But the reality is the future generations he's thinking about, I think, are basically his grandchildren, not my grandchildren or yours. This is a system that's so fundamental. It's like our highway system. We need to repair it at times. There's maintenance is needed, but you don't rip up the highway system because you have a couple of bumps in the road. And what they're trying to do is they're creating bumps, to a large extent, false bumps, calling it unsustainable, and selling that idea. And Pete Peterson, by the way, has put $1 billion. That's the B word, billion. Dollars into his own foundation in his name, dedicated to advocating against Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, fundamentally, and it is class warfare. But $1 billion buys you a huge amount of respectability and a lot of friends. And Democrats deserve, or moderates, and even some liberals deserve a fair amount of criticism as well, because they've been reticent at times to speak forcefully about this program, to connect. The American people are very clear. On poll after poll, they don't want to see it cut. They believe it's important. They are worried about its future. Young people don't think it'll be there. But at the same time, many of the people who didn't think it would be there in 1980 are now collecting benefits and know it is there and it will be there. They're concerned. You know, many older people, when you ask them, they know this isn't the core concern here is for younger people. The people that Pete Peterson will hurt the most are middle-aged workers who've lost huge amounts of equity and savings in the great in the crash of the economy, and people in the late 40s, and even younger people, because the proposals they've been pushing effectively eviscerate these kinds of protections for future generations. So the crocodile tears about worrying about the deficit is so just so unfortunate, and it doesn't help. We have an economy we need to invest in. We need to be moving an agenda that creates the conditions to add jobs to the economy. We should be dealing, our stimulus should be longer and wider than it has been to move people back into the workforce, those who are outside. If you want to help future generations, you invest in jobs. And ironically, the best thing you can do for Social Security financing is also invest in jobs in the long run, because once the economy returns to health, the trust funds are greatly improved.
So again, Eric Kingston, professor of social work at Syracuse University and the founding co-director of Social Security Works, an organization which launches and staffs the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. He served as policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982-83 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. But the Pete Peterson, who is behind, put $1 billion into demonizing Social Security and has had an effect, obviously, the fact that the Obama administration allowed him to pay for the staff of the Simpsons-Bowles Commission, which is the Deficit Reduction Commission, would indicate the extent to which the Democrats have rolled over for this guy who really is not a neutral observer, because he clearly has an agenda vis-a-vis Wall Street and getting his hands on all this money that Wall Street sees as this big pot of gold that they can snatch. And also it's worth noting that Peterson, his group, Blackstone Group, is one of the big donors to Mitt Romney, along with all the Wall Street banks, who, by the way, J.P. Morgan Chase had just posted record profits. They're all giving their money to Romney. So,
yeah, ironically, also Erskine Bowles is the director of Morgan Chase.
Erskine Bowles, the great the Democrat,
Simpson,
right?
Simpson Commission.
Right. So it seems to be pretty straightforward here that the fix is in from Wall Street.
Rant. We're in agreement here. The fix is in, and yet the American public does not want to see the program cut. Now, I'm going to preface this and say first, from a policy point of view, those of us who believe maintaining Social Security as a core commitment is very important. There's no question that the Romney-Ryan approach will decimate it. On the other hand, I'm going to say what's come out of the White House has not been a strong enough defense of the program. And in fact, there's no question the White House the Democratic ticket is far better in terms of the future of this program. It will maintain it. But they've been open. They've been somewhat ambivalent and haven't embraced it. Even that night, Mr. Biden danced around the question, and he historically has been an extraordinary supporter of Social Security. Democrats are tepid in their support. There are some wonderful advocates there, Congressman Deutsch, Bernie Sanders, the independent, Harry Reid, Senator Reid, and there are many others. But for the most part, they have not said, this is our Social Security, the people have built it, and we're going to maintain it. Instead, they've gone right to the center, and they say, well, we're going to have to be reasonable. Well, reasonable on Social Security today is not cutting benefits, because we have a real crisis. 5 years from now, as people move into retirement, we're going to be talking about this extraordinary crisis of people in their 50s and their 60s. Who are now facing a very diminished retirement situation. And the Democrats, which historically have been a party and that has seized on this, and in the past Republicans too have seized on protecting the American people with Social Security. It was Richard Nixon who put the cost of living adjustment in with a lot of push from Democrats, but he did it. And, you know, it's now we have legitimatized the notion that this is a problem, which it is not. In 1982, when I was staffed the Greenspan Commission, we had a real crisis because if Social Security legislation didn't move by 1983, benefits would have had to have been reduced for everyone. That's a crisis. It's a crisis for people who would lose benefits, and it's even a bigger crisis if you're a member of Congress, because you don't want to be in Congress if you cut Social Security. And they would never let that happen. But in 83, a reasonable set of changes was put forward. And back then, it made sense to have a combination of benefit reductions and some revenue increases. Back then, we had anticipated greater wage increases. We had anticipated greater equality in the distribution of our productivity in the economy. We had anticipated the continued growth of our occupational pension system. None of that's happened. Today, a balanced package means addressing Social Security on the revenue side. And when we step back and take a sober look at where we are, a balanced package is going to mean looking at ways to actually strengthen the benefits of the system.
Sure. Well, Bernie Sanders, as you mentioned, Eric Kingston, there's a simple fix, and that is that the rich who have done so well in this country, all they have to do, you know, they should be paying a little bit more than the average person, and that would be an easy fix. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, okay. And if you'd like further information, take a look at our website, strengthensocialsecurity.org. And please note, in the upcoming lame duck, our Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are at stake. We need to send messages to our representatives. Do not cut our system that's so critical to the protection of ourselves, our children, our grandchildren. And do exactly as you just said, Ian. Where we do need to bring in more revenues, let's be realistic and let's ask the people who've done very well in the past 15, 20 years, and especially the past 10, ask them to pay their fair share. The middle class has already given it the office. It's time for others to pony up on this.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Eric Kingston.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Eric Kingston, Professor of Social Work at Syracuse University, where he's also the founding co-director of the Social Security Works, an organization which launches and staffs the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. Kingston also served as policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982-83 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.